Hello, I'm back from Gallifrey 1 in Los Angeles, and apart from the bronchitis I may well have picked up after spending 3 days in the LAX Marriott basement at close quarters with 3,000 plus other fans, it was quite possibly my best time yet in my 9 times going. Sean Lyon, program director, who was a guest in my November 2023 episode of this podcast, was gracious enough to put me on 3 different panels. A podcasting panel with Deb from Verity, Chip from 2 Minute Time Lord, and Aaron from It's a Fandom Thing. And I got to moderate a supersized version of my old L.I. Who, Doctor Who 60 for 60 panel, the audio from which I played on this podcast in August 2023. But this time we had 10 panelists, including John Dorney and Lisa McMullen from Big Finish. Mark from Trap One played Scorekeeper, and a younger fan named Dylan, dressed as and eerily resembling David Tennant's 10th Doctor, played Timekeeper. The list of top 60 may well surprise you. And lastly, I got to moderate the Targets panel, which featured 4 recent Target authors: Paul Cornell, Gary Russell, Mark Morris, and James Goss, as well as Kathy Sullivan, whose voice you heard in the 60 for 60 episode last August. I got to interview Gary separately about his novelization of The Star Beast, and that audio, along with a list of the top 60, will feature on an upcoming episode. And Mark and I recorded several segments at Galley for a Trap One episode, which dropped yesterday. Check it out, won't you? There are several paid add-ons available at the con: autographs and photo sessions. I don't really do photos. It's rough enough looking into the mirror and saying hello to new white hairs every day. I don't need a photo of myself looking awkward next to Derek Jacobi or Billy Piper. But I do like paying for and going to the script readings, where you get the chance to run lines opposite one of the actor guests and walk away with an autographed script. I have done that with Mandip Gill and Jodie Whittaker in past years. This year, Derek Jacobi, on the Sunday, read from his first Big Finish War Master story, and Matthew Waterhouse read from the rehearsal scripts for Legopolis Part 2. "But Jason," you say, "Legopolis is your number one episode of all time. You already have it memorized and don't even need the script." But this was not the Legopolis camera script, so the dialogue is slightly different and therefore sounds wrong, even though it's the dialogue that was directly used for the Christopher H. Bidmead novelization. There were some young fans at the Waterhouse reading, one even dressed as Adric. But when the moderator wanted a volunteer to read for the monitor, well, I may have flunked out of drama camp in the early 80s, and one of the other students in that camp section was Mariah Carey. True story. The monitor is the role that I was born to play, baby. I got to deliver the line, "It is a perfectly logical copy," while looking directly at Matthew Waterhouse. That's not even my favorite monitor line from Part 2, though I love John Fraser's deliveries. But I did get to say it. Heck, during the closing ceremonies on Sunday night, Matthew even mentioned the script read and how the fans who got to read with him were a better Doctor, a better Adric, a better Romana, and a better monitor. That might even count as a personal shout-out direct from Matthew himself, although another fan also played the monitor as we read through the Part 2 cliffhanger material at the end of the session. So there's a 1-in-2 chance that my acting skills were just praised by Matthew Waterhouse himself. One other reason why Galley is such a great con, apart from the chance to catch one-on-one moments with the guests, is that it's multiple conventions rolled into one. There are 5 programming tracks at any given time, which does lead to having to make some painful choices about what has to be skipped. I didn't make it to Matthew Waterhouse's main stage interview, for example, and I never saw hide nor hair of Alex Kingston. But even apart from the 5 tracks all going on at once, there's a video room screening vintage and new episodes, though I confess I've never once gone into it in 9 times going to Galley. My side of the con is mostly GeezerCon. Lots of classic series fans with rapidly graying hair, and I'm afraid I fall into that category. Lots of Kevin McNally cosplayers showed up this year, though sadly McNally himself had to exit this year's Galley early on the first morning. GeezerCon is a very good side of Galley. It's a great place to discuss the classic series and meet my listeners. But there's another side of Galley, because fandom cannot sustain itself on geezers alone. If you're in the States, for example, just ask Major League Baseball what it's like having almost no audience under the age of 50. That other side is the kids. Saturday night, my little fan group and I visited first the dance party, and then the karaoke room. Both very different audiences from some of my classic series panels, and I was one of the only geezers in attendance at the dance party and the karaoke. Lots of young people at these cons, or people my age who bring their kids, almost always in costume. Lots of younger kids perform at karaoke too, at least before midnight. In one of those neat confluences, Let It Go and Defying Gravity were performed back-to-back by different fans. I mean, those are basically the same song, aren't they? Idina Menzel's misunderstood villain, getting her big empowerment number at the end of Act 1. But because this is a Doctor Who con, the fans and the karaoke know when and how to update the lyrics to make them more Doctor Who appropriate. Say it with me. It's time to try Defying Mavity. I think I'll try Defying Mavity. Yeah. The kids are all right. The younger fans, as always, will be the ones to save us. After the intro theme, Simon Gurrier will join both Mark from Trap One and me for a live interview recorded outside on the Saturday. I once heard that there are no great interviews, only great conversations. Thanks to Simon, this is one really great conversation. Let's get to it.
Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
So I am sitting here on the back patio at Gallifrey 1 with Simon Gurrier, a very distinguished guest. Simon, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, my great pleasure. I've been listening to you for ages. I often listen to you while I'm doing the washing up.
Oh my goodness, thank you. That's my competition, dishes.
Yeah.
I listen to most of my podcasts doing dishes. We live in a two-bedroom apartment in Brooklyn without a dishwasher, so I do the dishes, and that gives me a lot of podcast
time. You are the dishwasher.
That's right. So you have had a very prolific Doctor Who career going back 20 years. I remember your first book, The Time Travelers, which I adored, and that was, it seems like 5 minutes ago, but it was 20 years. And you have also done a lot of nonfiction, and you have done a lot of Big Finish. And I'm talking to you today about Time Lash. It hardly seems fair.
Well, the thing is, I love Time Lash. I love the TV Time Lash. I love the book Time Lash. As a kid, it just really excited me. But all of Doctor Who excited me. And I know that it's not very good. And I know the book is not brilliant. And I know there's lots of problems with it. But as a kid, I was absolutely spellbound by it. And there's a weird... reading this again, I can see what I loved as a kid. While my sort of professional critical brain is going, I would completely rewrite this and whatever. And I think that's really important because we kind of attach such importance to things that we watched as kids or that we've known for a long time. And that can blunt our critical faculties and stuff. And just because something was on when you were little doesn't mean that it's necessarily better. It's all those associations and things. So I find that really interesting. And I find being at Gallifrey and talking to people who are, you know, watching Doctor Who, old Doctor Who for the first time, their responses are really interesting because they feel really fresh, even if they challenge the things that I feel, because I've watched Mordred Undead 100 times.
You've watched it so many times, it's lost all meaning.
Well, it's more that what I find fascinating is that there are people who will watch it now who will point out things to me that I've never noticed or never made a connection with, which makes me want to go and watch it again. And, you know, that what you kind of have to do is embrace that. And there are people who are quite resistant to going, oh, you know, somebody's got a take that I don't agree with, or this isn't the established view. But I actually find it quite exciting and invigorating.
It's with Mordred Undead, you're talking about 41, 42-year-old television. You're not going to win an argument about it anymore. It's already been discussed.
Well, to be honest, it's a bit... I used to have a really good friend who was a fan of Crystal Palace Football Club. And I said to him, you know, they haven't been doing brilliantly or whatever. What do you get from going to the game every week? And he said, well, I've been doing it so long, whether they win or play well is completely beside the point. And I want them to do well, and I'm really pleased when they do well. But that's not what I'm in it for. you know. And I was kind of like, yeah, that's my Doctor Who thing now, I think. The idea of, is this a good story or is it, I have gone beyond that point. You know, kind of like the end of 2001 where they go through the Stargate. And
yes.
Yeah, that is where I'm at now.
I have a similar point of view too, because I did my pilgrimage starting in late 2020 during the pandemic, and I watched the entirety of the classic series.
Okay.
Two 25-minute episodes a night, or in the case of Time Lash, one 45-minute episode per night.
Yeah.
And it took about 13 months. I did have a couple of short gaps to wait for animated Patrick Troughton DVDs to arrive.
Okay.
They thoughtfully were released right on time for my watching them in my schedule. I realized that every classic series stories is my favorite for at least some point after the opening credits to part one. That may quickly evaporate 30 minutes into the Android Invasion or 20 minutes into Invisible Enemy, but every classic series story I love in some degree or another, and I've lost the ability to hate some of these stories.
Yeah. I also think that one of the things that fascinates me about Time Lash is that it doesn't quite, you know, that there's something not working in Time Lash that, as a fan, I can grapple with. If I had been the script editor and this was on my watch, what would I have done? You know, you can't throw money at it. The budget is limited. You can't change the director or the cast or whatever. But what can you fix on the day? And I find I can, that gives me something to, you know, I can see myself in that role and I can be a participant in that. And chatting to people like you, we could compare notes on what we would do or have ideas. Whereas an episode like Blink, for example, which is so perfect and it's such an intricate piece of whatever, there's no way in for me. So oddly, I find Time Lash a more satisfying sort of place as a fan than Blink, which I kind of bounce off because there's nothing I can really, you know, I can talk about things I like in Blink, but I don't really feel like I can participate in it. And, you know, I know that sounds a bit odd, but That's kind of what I find interesting, and where I think all the fandom is about participation. You know, if you look at people here at Gallifrey, there are people who are dressing up, there are people who are wanting to write, there are people who are making little videos, there are people who are doing podcasts. Fandom is all about not just being a passive viewer. It's about becoming part of the thing that you love and kind of taking it on. And so weirdly, that's kind of why Time Lash really appeals to me.
Nicola Bryan, this was many years ago, had directed a Big Finish audio.
Yeah.
And during one of the bonus interviews on the discs, she said, this is a script that has a lot of characters in it. And she made a point that I had never considered before, not being a director or theatrical in any way. But she said, oftentimes, a script with too many characters is a sign that the author does not know how to tell his story. But in this case, she made an exception. I am almost positive she got that lesson from Time Lash. In theater, you can have three actors on stage who were killed off in Act 1, Scene 1, and then use them throughout the rest of the production as extras and in background roles, and a lot of plays do that. But in Doctor Who, if you have three random character names, or I don't know, Gazak, Tyhir, random syllables merged together, and they have a big role in the first 5 minutes of the story, and then are killed off and never seen again, in Doctor Who, they are dead to the camera. They can't be reused later on in the story. It's almost a waste of having three actors come in for the first 5 minutes of the serial, and then never used again. And there's many redundant characters. There's like seven different counselors. There's two or three different rebels. There's a lot of cast going on, and there's not enough real estate in the story to give everybody an emotionally satisfying part.
Yes, there are things that you can do. So one of the things that Doctor Who is quite good at is giving somebody a good single scene or a sort of a one-episode character who's very effective. So examples of that are things like the film star George Koulouris, who's in Citizen Kane.
Yes.
Is in the first episode of Keys of Marinus, only in the first episode, and gets bumped off, and that's a bit of a surprise twist. And that means he only commits to 1 week. A character I absolutely love is in The Impossible Astronaut, is Joy in the bathroom of the White House, who is the woman in the toilets and
yes,
whatever. And you just go, and in just that one scene, you get a real sense of this character and this person. She feels very real, and then she's bumped off, which makes it a shock. And by making her such a vivid character, which is beautifully played as well, by making that a vivid character, you feel her loss. So that works very effectively. But you're absolutely right. It's something that Big Finish, long before I started, but they fixed on, which is we haven't got the money for a big cast. So you've got to use the small number of characters as effectively as possible. And what that means is where you might be tempted to have two walk-on parts, you've kind of got to put those together and use them. So actually what that does is it makes all the characters have more to do and give them a bigger role in the story. So effectively you write better for them as a result of that restriction. And you're right, that Time Lash has got a lot of characters who, what they're doing, why are they there, who are they? Do we have a sense of their world and how they, you know, how does the words they say and the choices of the vocabulary suggest a worldview and a perspective that's different from our own or distinct from each other? There's not really any of that kind of thing in there, in the way that, you know, Robert Holmes was brilliant at that sort of thing, and created a number of double acts, of duos in his stories, who can kind of comment on proceedings and kind of give you a skewed perspective. And all it does is add a level of richness to the world he's creating. And that's not really, Time Lash doesn't really have that.
And what hurts Time Lash is that it's airing directly after a 3-week Robert Holmes epic, The Two Doctors. So it's immediately following on from Chesine and Shockeye.
Yes, yes. And I think The Two Doctors, I love The Two Doctors, but I think The Two Doctors is flawed. Revelation of the Daleks has a number of structural problems. I think Mark of the Rani has a number of problems. Those are all written by experienced TV writers, and there are problems. And my understanding is that as script editor, Eric Saward was attempting to address those issues, and that meant he wasn't as on Time Lash as he should have been, maybe, where you have a very inexperienced writer. And Glenn McCoy's a lovely man. I've met him, and we've had a conversation about what was on screen when he was a young man is not what he would write now, and, you know, all of these kind of things. But I think he got a bad deal because he should have been better looked after, really. And there's that's all because of the logistics of what was going on at the time, and I don't want to apportion blame. But again, I find all of that fascinating as a way in of kind of going, you just wouldn't make television like that now, because people would be better supported. And what they do, what John Nathan Turner tries to do to balance the fact that it's a script by a first-time writer or a relatively green writer, is he brings in a director with a lot of experience. And the idea is that that will balance out. But you kind of go, there's only so much you can do in rehearsal to fix problems in the script.
Right.
But also, Colin Baker and Nicola Bryan missed the beginning of rehearsals because they were at a convention in the States.
Oh.
And they missed the end of the rehearsals because they were in pantomime. And you kind of go, the priority is not on making a good show. And everything else is kind of taking too much focus away from making Time Lash work. And that's what you see on screen. And I find that fascinating. And when you watch the programme, you're like, oh, yeah, because look, you know, part of the issue is the guest cast are playing it the way they want to play it. And actually, they should be kind of taking their lead from Colin Baker, who sets the tone for Doctor Who, because he's the Doctor. But because he's not been around, they've kind of done their own thing.
So Paul Darrow is elevating himself to fill the gap.
Yeah, and I think that would be my interpretation of it. I haven't spoken to him or Colin about this, but that would be my interpretation of it, and that's what you would do, because you're trying to make it work. So you're trying to, you know, you can see it in stories like The Crotons, not the best script. Again, very green writer, in this case Robert Holmes.
Yes.
And Patrick Troughton is working very hard to lift the material by doing lots of visual stuff, and he makes it very entertaining to watch. The Crotons is an audio story. If you imagine it being a missing story, people go, it's not that great. But on screen, there's lots of visual interest because Troughton is working very hard to keep you interested. So I find all of that fascinating.
I want to say, in defense of Paul Dow and Mark from Trap One, I don't know if you agree, when you have a script that has this many problems in it, an actor needs to do something to make you want to watch the story. A villain is not a villain unless you want to reach through the screen or the cathode ray tube and punch them in the face. Paul Darrow's expression and sneering at the part one cliffhanger makes you want to reach through the television and assault him, which I think is the mark of a good TV villain, especially of that era.
I think I loved Paul, and I worked with him a bit, I think he's amazing in Blade 7, and he was lovely to work with. And I think the issue with Time Lash is one of tone, and there's no agreement on what the tone of it should be. If you look at the next story in production, which is Revelation of the Daleks, that is all tone. And Graham Harper is kind of going, I've got this script, and it's a gritty thriller, and quite dark, and quite caustic. That's what we're going to do. And Time Lash is kind of, well, we're kind of making it up as we go along in front of drapes. And has that kind of slightly awkward Acorn Antiques-y kind of, you know, I would actually enjoy it more if there was a bit more double-taking at the camera and wobbly scene, you know, that kind of thing. But that's a problem, because the script doesn't kind of give you enough of what this should feel like. And the staging doesn't give you enough of what this should feel like. And that's partly because it's studio-bound, but Vengeance on Pharos is studio-bound and has a much more... The tone of it is much more consistent. But Time Lash is quite silly and light, like a lot of children's television of the time. And yet, it's trying to be a bit intellectual and about the history of science fiction, but old school science fiction. And yet it's also trying to be, it's got that kind of what a lot of 80s Doctor Who stories have, which is a kind of business ethos, people talking about shares and share options kind of stuff. So it's this weird mashup, which doesn't, none of it quite gels. And what you kind of need is somebody to give it some direction as to what it should be, you know, because it's, There's an element where you're kind of going, this is supposed, what you're trying to achieve in the studio is something like David Lynch's Dune. That's the kind of,
right,
you know, it's a desert planet and there's systems and there's weird punishments and there's whatever. And you can't really do that with flat walls and, you know, all of those things. I find, you know, there's something there that I think could be really good. But how do you get there from what is presented? And I find that fascinating.
That's a very good point about Dune. Is that the reason why the line, to be perfectly Frank Herbert, is embedded into this story, or is that a complete happy accident?
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know how literary the team were and who would have put that in. But maybe. I mean, Dune was out in cinemas at, 84, 85? So,
yes.
You know, even if they hadn't read it, they would have known that that was a thing.
It was the cultural osmosis or the psychopornography of the time.
Yes. Those are the words I was going to use.
I do want to say also about Colin Baker is the high point of the story for me. There's two moments that Colin Baker puts into this story that makes you love him as the Doctor. The actor who plays Herbert is chasing him around the cottage in Scotland in the 19th century and is trying very earnestly to brain him over the head with a fireplace poker and to exorcise him. Colin Baker still had the physicality at that time, and this is the same season where he leaps over a couch in Twin Dilemma from a standing position, which I could not do that in a gazillion years, even when I was younger and more athletic. Colin Baker effortlessly bobs and weaves and ducks us without even acting as if it's bothering the character. He's having a full conversation while he's doing this. It's an incredibly physical comic performance, which is a grace note to the story. And comparing to the novelization, which we'll talk about in a moment, the Doctor sends an android back in time, and that android had already been seen catching fire, materializing in the middle of nowhere earlier in the story. In the novelization, they tell the Doctor about this, and he makes some timey-wimey, complicated sentence about, I'm pleased to know that my plan will have worked. On TV, all Colin Baker does is, what? That's hilarious. That's the way you take a terrible line like that, you say, what? That's much funnier.
Yeah. I think, I really love Colin's Doctor. And you're right about the physicality. I think also, as with Troughton, you can see him working really hard to make it as good as possible. And the problem with being the lead in anything, the lead actor, is you're completely dependent on the scripts and the writing and the support around you, and you're the visible one. And if the script isn't good, if the script isn't working, or the director isn't on their marks or whatever, as the star, what can you do? And yes, you can suggest line changes, or you can suggest, how about we do this? But you're working against the clock. You know, the moment there's a hold up, the crew are all getting cross because they're like, oh, we're going to be here late and whatever. So you're very limited in your options as to what you can do. And all you can really do is kind of set the tone of the working space, because you're the lead. So the mood of the day is often set by you as the star. And you can try and correct stuff, but on the hoof. And yeah, you can see him trying to, you know, let's give this some energy, let's give this some pace, let's give this some drama, and, you know, moving around. And yeah, the not everybody is working as hard as he is.
Yes, some of the acting performances are cardboard at best.
Well, it's all just a bit, it's not very, people aren't really living it, are they? There's not a lot of real, they're not convinced of the roles that they're playing and stuff. So it's just, and the thing is, that's a mode of sort of theatre. That's a very stage way of mounting things. But this is an era when sci-fi is Star Wars and Return of the Jedi and Dune and whatever, which has made everything feel much more tangible and real, and space is grubby and all of those kind of things. And Doctor Who isn't doing that enough. So it feels even more like a relic of a bygone age. And that, you know, all of that, I find, you know, their sensibilities to that, they've just, there's a kind of disconnect in what they're trying to make and what their stuff is being compared to by the viewer. And, you know, now, making Doctor Who, they're all like, well, we haven't got the budget of Marvel, but that's kind of where we've got to be. That's what we're going to be judged against.
Right.
So we've got to find ways to do stuff that puts us in that same space, even though we can't compete on a, you know, is it completely unfair to judge Doctor Who on that kind of scale, because the budgets are so different and the way the means of production are so different. But that's what people see when they watch it. So you can see the production team kind of going, well, there are things we can do, and there are things that we're just not going to bother with, because, you know, those kind of things. There's no kind of thinking like that with Time Lash.
Let's segue into the book. We each have our copies with us here on the back patio at Galley. Your copy is a little more well-read than mine is. My copy reflects exactly where I was emotionally as a Doctor Who fan in 1986.
Excellent.
The next time this story came around on television, I sat there in front of the TV with my pencil, flipping the pages to keep up with the scenes. And that is difficult in Time Lash because the book is so radically restructured. What I did not know as a young 13, 12-year-old American fan is that I was not watching the actual 45-minute Time Lash. I was watching the syndicated version in four parts.
Right.
Where the cliffhangers to quote-unquote part one and quote-unquote part three make very little sense. And that bedeviled me throughout the entire Colin Baker era, which ends, the season 22 ends with this story. But you will see that in my book, I have the part four
Excellent.
Cliffhanger mark, and I have another one for the part two cliffhanger. These are not the TV cliffhangers, and I even added in pencil Perry saying yes sir as they exit the TARDIS. That would have been a Nicola Bryant ad lib.
Yeah, excellent.
Which would not appear in the book based on an older version. So this is not, and I say this not as a writer but as a critic and as a lover of writing, this is not a good book, in that the prose is very dry. And the first, so I'll talk about this later during the audio essay half, the first sentence of the book is not very good, unless you're a Jimi Hendrix fan, Purple Haze being the first phrase. It doesn't really put you in. Terrence Dix will tell you what this book is about. This is more of a weather report, and I find the prose a little turgid, if not too messed.
Yeah,
to use inappropriate words.
I think, I mean, I was thinking I must find a telling sentence to give your listeners a feel of what this book is. And actually, I was rather spoiled for choice. But I think this is a classic. This is a dramatic moment in the TARDIS, and this is how it's conveyed. With the threat of total obliteration, would there be time for the Doctor to avert what seemed increasingly inevitable? And you kind of go, that's so clunky, and it should be vivid and using vocabulary that's evocative and exciting, and it should draw you on. And it's almost like it's been translated from another language. It's so just boring is the problem, and very functional. It's like something from a textbook rather than a physics textbook rather than a an adventure. And so what you've got, this odd thing, is the whole idea is that this should be a dramatic, exciting story which has lots of short scenes and jumps about and whatever, but none of those scenes take you forward. None of those scenes ends on a cliffhanger that makes you want to go know what's happening next. So it's just a series of kind of odd little vignettes of nothing really happening. And also, the Doctor and Perry bickering isn't dramatic. It kind of creates a tension and a conflict, but not one that's going anywhere. Whereas, you know, in another story where the kind of idea of, you know, scenes don't play against each other, so you don't cut to something that then plays against what you've just seen,
right,
or whatever, such as the Doctor going, I'm sure we're going to have a lovely welcome here, cut to everybody raise your guns to the TARDIS, cut back to, you know, all of that kind of playfulness and stuff that just keeps you interested in whatever. It's not doing any of the things to hook your attention. And I kind of think of there's an interview with Roald Dahl about writing children's stories, which I you know, has really stuck with me for a long time. And he said, somebody asked him, what do you think about when you're writing? What, you know, what's the number one thing? And he says, what I'm really conscious of is that children could do anything else but read my books. They could go out and play. They could turn on the television. They could have computer games or whatever. So I've got to find ways to keep their attention. And that means I've got to have the story has got to move, and it's got to have surprises all the way through it, and funny bits and whatever, so that you keep reading. And he said, and what I hope is that somebody goes, well, I'll read a chapter, oh, I've read three. That's kind of what you're hoping to do is read it. And I read Time Lash going, there is none of that in this. I'm not quite sure what you think you're doing with this. Other than kind of producing a report on what the TV version was. And as an editor, I'm kind of like, there's loads to fix in this that you could improve on. And it's a shame. And, you know, again, I loved this as a kid. Absolutely loved it. Because it, you know, I didn't have a video, so I didn't have my way to watch it again. But I thought this was what adult writing was, because it was difficult. And I thought, you know, I'm reading a grown-up book about a grown-up adventure and stuff, because I was eight and didn't know any better. And now I look at it and go, yeah, this is... I couldn't get my own kids to read something like this now. They'd just be like, what? I don't understand any of it.
There are passages and sequences in the book that do not appear on television. So
yes.
There is a single paragraph subplot about 24 extra Borag clones that could have been a whole chapter in and of itself, but instead it's mentioned and then disposed of in a single sentence later on. You also have, 250 androids attacking the control room rather than one. That is a decent use of the book medium, and it adds tension and drama that wouldn't have been on television. However, in the hands of Glenn McCoy's prose, maybe this doesn't come to life as well as it might have done in a Terrence Dix book.
Yeah, I think the issue is that you can do scale in the book, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily dramatic. Because what you need is the tension and what's at stake. And that's what's missing from Time Lash. At any moment, what is at stake? And the thing is, people get hurled into the Time Lash But the only person that we see the results of that is Vina, who just arrives in the Highlands of Scotland and is fine. So what is the threat? What is the problem? Has everybody been thrown in a time lash? Have they all just settled in Scotland and are having a lovely time? Is that...
The rolling green hills and vast loch of 12th century Scotland. Time lash me up, baby. I would love to go there.
Yeah. And are they all happy? You know, that would be a great gag if the Doctor arrives in the Highlands of Scotland and there are all these people who are having a lovely time. Kind of going, if only we'd known. And
we are sitting by the Sisterhood of Carnage.
Yeah, this is amazing.
That's lovely cosplay, including a small child. Those are lovely costumes. But it begs the question, all these characters are supposedly killed. Brunner, or maybe it's Kendrin, I can't tell which is which, and the rebels at the very beginning of the story. The Doctor could just go to 12th century Scotland, retrieve them, and bring them home. They're not actually dead.
Yeah, so it's there's all sorts of things like that. There's also
one more time.
Why has nobody, you know, all the kind of things that they're fighting a rebellion to achieve? Yes. What? There's no sense of what the people. Oh, we want to be. But what are you? Is there an alternate system? You've got this war and things. What? How are you going to deal with all of these things? Have not really been thought through. Because there's not an effort to make it a particularly richly realised thing. So it's all very disappointing. You know, I think one of the things that's really noticeable on the cover is in creating a credible alien world, they've shown us planet Jupiter, and they've not even bothered to take off the spot. So it's like, this is supposed to be a far distant world. It's like, no, that's Jupiter. I know where that is. You know, it's the equivalent of if they'd done a bit of location filming in Shepherd's Bush, where TV Centre is, and it was just a normal street. And they go, no, this is Mars.
And this is not an Andrew Skilleter cover. It's a bit of a crowded montage.
Yeah, it's David McAllister, isn't it? And yes. I think it's a, you know, actually, the Borat is a really, really good bit of makeup.
Yes.
And Robert Ashby's performance is amazing. He's a really good villain. And I think Penn and Roberts cast very well, actually. And there's a lot of very good actors in Time Lash, like Steve McIntosh and stuff,
yes,
who went on to an amazing career. They're just ill-served by the script.
So if you have some time, I want to segue to some of your other books.
Yes, of course.
Mark and I yesterday sat in on your panel, which was the first panel that we saw. This is Mark's first Gallifrey one.
Okay.
And he's going to think it's all like that.
Okay.
You did a panel on the evolution of television and how the first season of Doctor Who is an essential part of the DNA of TV. There were two things I learned yesterday that I did not know from your panel, which blew my mind.
Just two?
Well, more than that, but the two that I'm still talking about 24 hours later.
Okay.
The first day of broadcast of the BBC is November 2nd, 1936.
Yes.
And you went through the schedule, some of which we would not ever show again or script again today. The variety show with the ethnic acts. But the very first dramatic piece ever performed on the BBC, it's four dramatic actors doing an excerpt from a play. One of those actors in 1936 later appears on Doctor Who three times, as late as a story broadcast in the year 1980.
Yes.
It is incredible to me that Doctor Who, even in season 17, has an actor who was the very first dramatic actor ever shown on the BBC ever.
Yes, I find John Bailey, who is in The Censorites, The Evil of the Daleks, and The Horns of Nymon. Amazing actor, amazing career. On the same night that The Evil of the Daleks was being shown, he would be seen later the same evening in The Forsyte Saga, which was the big prestigious BBC drama. His extraordinary career, he's in stuff with, there's an amazing, is it Tales of the Unexpected? One of those kind of anthology shows with a twist, which is him and Peter Cushing as old friends meeting up and reminiscing. And what you and the twist at the end, which I will spoil for your listeners, so you could turn off if you want, but the twist is at the end is that they are ex-Nazi officers who are in prison.
Oh my goodness.
And they're doing their round before they go back to the cells. And all their genteelness and all their manners and all their reminiscing he's you know, put into sharp relief by this revelation. And he's amazing, absolutely amazing. But as you say, he, at age 24, he was in the first ever drama production on TV. I should say, pedants will point out that the BBC had done a number of experimental broadcasts, which had included excerpts of drama plays. So it's not the first ever thing televised, but it was from the first week of regular television broadcast that basically television was on every day. So it's kind of the first of, as the BBC, as a service rather than an experiment.
You also showed clips from a TV show that had aired in Doctor Who's slot, a long-running series of serials called Gary Halliday, which I was totally ignorant being in the States. Mark and I are laughing our heads off. You showed the first 3 minutes of the one surviving episode. It is a montage. Yes, I'm sorry. Of 17 different characters being introduced.
Yeah.
By the narrator. It's so clumsy and it's so bad.
It's magnificent. It's a magnificent bit of television. And, yes, it's very complex. So that's just episode three. And episode three, by the point of episode three, the plot has got so twisty that they're a very long introduction. It's also, it then plays into an episode where the camera is very static and everybody is playing it rather over the top. So it's very stagey and unconvincing for all its melodramatic and stuff. So it feels like a parody because so many things have mocked this kind of television since.
Yes.
But at the time, that's what a lot of television was like. But yes, it was shown in the you know, 5:15 on a Saturday tea time. So in exactly the same slot that Doctor Who would take. And really importantly, it was written by two writers who wrote under the pseudonym Justin Blake. And they wrote the first four serials. And then they kind of went, well, we've had enough and we've killed off the villain. So they basically went, well, we want to continue it. So we'll do the writing in-house. So one of the in-house writers of the BBC, a guy called David Whittaker, wrote Serial 5.
Oh, wow.
So he had written Children's Adventure Serial for that slot 2 years before he was on Doctor Who, which I find fascinating. And then they did books. So one of the writers it's John Bullimore and... No, John Bowen and Jeremy Bullimore were Justin Blake. And John Bowen went on to write episodes of The Ghost Story for Christmas. He co-created Hetty Wainthrop. Amazing career. But he published novels with Faber, like adult novels. And because he already had a publishing deal, Faber said, well, why don't we do books of Gary Halliday? So they did five novelizations, including a novelization of David Whittaker's serial for Gary Halliday, which came out in 1965. So after Doctor Who and An Exciting Adventure with the Daleks. And that boggles my head.
Wow.
But this wasn't the only novelization of TV, because obviously TV couldn't be repeated if it wasn't recorded, because it was live broadcast. So there was an amazing woman called Joy Harrington, who was a producer and director, but she had been an actress. She has an uncredited role in the movie Gaslight. And if you've seen the John Mills Quatermass serial, at the beginning he's interviewed on television and there's a riot going on outside. And we see the director in the booth calling the shots. And that woman is Joy Harrington.
Oh, wow.
Amazing woman, amazing career. And she wrote and directed a BBC serial called Jesus of Nazareth, which was the first time that Jesus had been seen on screen, really. And they had location filming in Jerusalem and Galilee and stuff. It was amazing. And they did a novelization. She wrote a novelization of that story. And then she did a follow-up series in 1960 called Paul of Tarsus, similarly with location filming. The character, or the role of St. Paul, was played by Patrick Troughton,
oh, wow,
who appears on the cover of the book 6 years before he's on the cover of the Doctor Who annual. So when the Doctor Who production office is approached by publisher going, can we do novels of Doctor Who stories, there is already a precedent for this. and already a form that David Whittaker and other people would have been familiar with. David Whittaker worked with Joy Harrington. She produced his first play for TV. So all and she had an office on the same floor at Threshold House. So all of those things feed into there being Doctor Who books.
Wow. So that's an even longer DNA than I imagined. You also showed a clip from, I think it was ITV or ABC, the Pathfinders to Venus. So you showed us the first few minutes of that
series. I should say these things are all on YouTube, so you can go and have a look. If you're if you've been bad and you want to punish yourself, go and watch this. They are extraordinary. And I find them, a bit like Time Lash, I find them absolutely captivating and fascinating. And they are awful.
And one of the actors, hurling himself to the studio floor after being chased by pterodactyls on Venus, is George Caloris, who was in Citizen Kane and who was Betty Davis's favorite co-star.
Yes.
What is going through his mind as he's rolling around in the sand?
Well, Caloris is really interesting because he's one of those actors who just wanted to work and be busy. So he's in all sorts of things. He's in some dreadful Amicus sci-fi horror movies and things. Because he would just take whatever came his way. And he's very good. And what he does, he's one of those actors that whatever you put him in, he gives a bit of gravitas and class to. A bit like Peter Cushing or any of these horror actors, where that's why you get them in. Because they'll come in and do it. They're not too pretentious about it. They'll do a good job. And they'll make your production better. And but he's exactly who Sidney Newman... I don't think there's anything in paperwork saying we were thinking of Caloris for Doctor Who, but that's exactly a Caloris type is what Doctor Who is.
Wow. And you then showed still photos from a surviving episode of Compact, and you talked about the evolution of how you go from a clumsy 3-minute Gary Holler style montage of face after face after face to do a 56-second montage with 4 actors that tells the entire story.
Yeah, so that episode of Compact is up on YouTube, so you can watch it. It's not in the best quality, and I'm not sure whether that's because of YouTube or because it was just not recorded in a very good quality. So Compact was a twice-weekly soap, broadcast live. They made 373 episodes between 1962 and 1965, of which 4 survived. So Doctor Who fans are very lucky. Could be a lot. Our missing episode situation could be a lot worse. But pretty much everybody who worked on Doctor Who worked on Compact. So the first episode, the second episode was directed by Christopher Barry. Warris Hussein was working on Compact immediately before he came onto Doctor Who. Donald Tosh was the script editor of Compact for a bit.
Wow.
Morris Fahey, who pitched to Doctor Who and met with David Whittaker.
The fragile yellow arc of fragrance, was that it?
That's exactly right. So the upshot of that is that David Whittaker went, I'm not sure this is right for Doctor Who, but next door is Donald Tosh, going to talk to him, and Morris Fahey wrote 2 episodes of Compact. So that kind of cross-pollination, but as you say, the opening 56 seconds of... So there's not a photo montage of the recap. It's a very swift, fast-moving sequence that brings you up to speed on everything that you need to know. And the point is, it doesn't tell you everything. It just tells you what you need to know is at stake. And this is actually something I learned doing Big Finish, but I learned it from working on radio, so with Big Finish, you could assume that most listeners will be listening attentively, probably on high-end kit.
Yes.
With, stereo sound and stuff. And you can use that within the storytelling and paint kind of widescreen Baroque things and make it immersive. Whereas on radio, broadcast radio, you kind of have to assume that people are listening with one ear and they might be doing the gardening or they might be doing the washing up or they might come in halfway through. So what you have to do is every so often kind of bring people up to speed on what matters. And that doesn't mean that you have somebody go, and as we've seen, documentaries do this. You come back from the break and go, here's a summary of the whole documentary so far. You don't need that. You just need to go, what's at stake?
Right.
And actually, that's a really good thing to do in drama anyway, and storytelling anyway, just to keep people up to speed. And my favourite example of it is in Skyfall, the James Bond film, where they arrive at this old house, and there's a gamekeeper who's clearly been written to be played by Sean Connery, but he turned them down. And Albert Finney says to James Bond, "So, what's going on?" And James Bond says, "There's some bad guys. They're going to try and kill us, and we're going to kill them first." And Albert Finney goes, "Oh, righto." Perfect. Absolutely perfect.
Wasn't Tom Baker up for that role that went to Albert Finney? Did I hear that?
I didn't know that. I did know John Logan had it in mind. Where, you know, the whole thing of we're going to go back in time. And then it would be Sean Connery. And Sean Connery could be a bit flirty with Judi Dench. And you go, oh, and he turned him down. And I think Albert Finney's great, but just the idea of Daniel Craig and Sean Connery and Judi Dench having a shootout is,
it hurts to not have that.
Yeah.
And then you showed in your presentation yesterday a slide capture from the closing credits. Two things about that made me goosebumps. Number one, it's the same font as the 1963 Doctor Who credits.
Yeah, so the BBC credits had a form, and they had a thing, and they were all done by the same department. So they used the same typeface and the same roller captions.
And the two names you showed were both directors of Doctor Who deep into the 1970s, producer Alan Bromley, director Christopher Barry.
Yeah, and when Doctor Who... So they were all at TV Centre, and then on the 18th of November 1963, because of... the BBC had to take on more staff because of BBC Two coming, which meant they had to make more stuff. So in November 1963, a whole bunch of the drama department was moved out of TV Centre to this office block on Shepherd's Bush Green. And that, so that was the production office of Doctor Who from that day until 1990 when John Nathan Turner closed it down.
Wow.
And it was a row of, you know, you went up to the fifth floor and there was a corridor and offices off the corridor. And David Whittaker was in one room, and then Verity Lambert was in the next room, and then Rex Tucker was in the next room, and then the people making Compact were in the next room, and then the people doing Thrillers were in the next room. So this kind of cross-pollination of things would happen, and things like in 1965, the end of 1965, Ian Stuart Black, who was a very well-respected TV writer and film writer, goes for a meeting with one team on that corridor, and as he's leaving, he sees the door says Doctor Who, and he goes, "Oh, my children like that." So he knocks on the door and goes, "Can I do a Doctor Who?" And John Wiles goes, yes, you can, whatever you want.
In fact, do two back to back.
Well, yeah, and so that kind of cross-pollination of things is happening. But also, John Wiles was in the office next door to Verity Lambert. So they were kind of like, well, she's leaving. Who do we get? Well, we get him, and he can shadow her. And so all of that is going on. But that's where the writers are coming from, that's where the directors are coming from, all the PAs, the production assistants. So Douglas Camfield, who wrote an episode of Gary Halliday.
Oh, wow.
Who met his wife while he was working on Gary Halliday.
Sheila Dunn.
She was an extra, as they called, a supporting artist in an episode. He is working on the floor below. He's in an office on the floor below with Christopher Barry and Michael Ferguson, and Michael Bryant, who then goes on to do the Sea Devils and Robots of Death and whatever. So all of this kind of cross-pollination. And what's really important is that what we keep seeing is there's a kind of institutional memory that there are people making the Robots of Death and, you know, who are on the crew, whether that's the director or the camera people or the secretaries or whatever, who've been on Doctor Who since it began, but have also worked on all these other things beforehand. The histories of Doctor Who, because it tends to look at a story in isolation, it misses those connections.
And I believe Michael Ferguson is the Dalek waving the sink plunger at Barbara, the famous cliffhanger to episode one of...
He is definitely the hand on the shoulder of Susan.
Wow.
I think he might be the sink plunger.
Or the Dalek sucker arm, to put it more indelicately.
I think... Did I hear somebody suggest otherwise, that it was somebody else? Or am I thinking that we know the name of the person who was on the camera that does the zoom? Yes, Toby Hager knows these things. I can't remember offhand. Go and listen to his podcast.
Of course. I highly recommend that, of course. next point, the second point that really blew us away is that the second in-house writer at the BBC after Nigel Neal is the grandfather of Bill Potts.
Yeah, so Pearl Mackey's grandfather, Philip Mackey, I think he was the second Starfighter. He might have been the third. Anthony Stevens, who wrote The Twin Dilemma, was also one of the early in-house scriptwriters. Judith Kerr, Nigel Neal's wife, who went on to do The Tiger Who Came to Tea, was on the team. And she left the BBC in December 1957 to go and have her daughter. And David Whittaker joined the BBC as a staff writer in October 1957. So there's a possibility that David Whittaker got a job at the BBC to be maternity cover for Judith Kerr.
Wow.
That would make sense, but they might have just been expanding the department. But Philip Mackey, so Nigel Neal and Philip Mackey both left the BBC, I think, in 1955. Basically, ITV started in 1955 and they needed writers. And they, amazing sort of drain of resources from the BBC, because they all got paid more. So loads of people left the BBC, and the BBC had to recruit more people. And Mackey went off to be the head of drama at Granada, a big ITV franchise. And then, you know, he's prolific in the 60s and 70s, but big, prestigious drama. He's a big name in telly. And, you know, go and look him up. It was amazing, amazing stuff he was doing.
And you've been more than generous with your time. If you could handle a couple of questions about this magisterial
volume. Oh, of course,
yes. And I have the hardcover on the David Whittaker. So you've talked about this book on other podcasts, and I don't want to duplicate what other excellent podcasters have done. But as this is a novelization show, David Whittaker writes two incredible novelizations that still bear rereading over and over again. And then he begins work on the novelization of Enemy of the World. And you recently found the first page, and heartbreakingly, only the first page of that novelization, which is written in a delightful children's book style. What can you tell us about David Whittaker when it comes to his two and a fraction novelizations that we might not have known before you started to research this incredible book?
So I think there's a number of things, one of which is that there seems to be no suggestion that anybody else would write the first novelization. Terry Nation's not going to do it, and David goes for it. And I think that is because he wasn't... So before David was on Doctor Who, he was a staff writer for the BBC and did a lot of day job work. And then he was also writing in the evenings and weekends and getting extra fees for that work. And in October 1963, the Screenwriters Guild, what's now the Writers Guild of Great Britain, which I'm on the executive board of.
Oh, wow.
They objected to what they referred to as shopping down the corridor, which is that BBC staff writers would employ each other to do writing, and that this wasn't a fair system. And the upshot of this is that David, who had earmarked a slot in the first year of Doctor Who for him to write a seven-part serial himself, wasn't able to do it. And they had to kind of open that out to somebody else. And I think the result of that was that he had planned to do a French Revolution story and Dennis Spooner got to do it instead. And that meant... So David was probably earning about £2,000 a year as a staff salary, and he was earning another £1,000 a year on extra bits of work. And so effectively, not being allowed to do that anymore drops his salary by a third.
Wow.
And I think that's why he leaves and hands in his notice. And he's also kept very busy as well. Doctor Who was a punishing schedule. So what he does is he makes up the shortfall by doing extracurricular work in other media. So he does the novelisation and he does the Dalek book, both of which he's writing while overseeing that first year of Doctor Who. And that's amazing. And more than the novelization of the Daleks is a pretty faithful version of the TV serial. He changes a few things. You know, obviously the copyright on the first TV serial is still a contentious issue. So he changes that, and he bases that on something that seems to have been a real life incident that affected his mum. And that this is not
the Barnes Common crash.
Yeah.
Wow.
And this is not the first and only example of David using elements of his own life and his family's life. Like, I don't know, his sister-in-law was called Barbara. And his fiance, before they got married, lived on a road in London called Cheniston Gardens. And if you stand by the door and look up the street, there's a sign that says Wright's Lane.
Ah.
And his brother and his sister-in-law lived a short walk across Kensington High Street from there. So if you walked from David Whittaker's fiance's flat to his brother's flat, and you cross Kensington High Street, you go past the estate agent that's still there called Chesterton's.
Oh my goodness.
Now maybe that's all of a coincidence, but I think it's less outrageous than the claim that Anthony Coburn named Chesterton after G.K. Chesterton, the famous writer and philosopher who Ian Chesterton is nothing at all like. So those kind of things I think are quite interesting. But the Dalek book is another, that is an extraordinary piece of writing, because what it does is an annual, so it's, you know, as an annual, comic strips, short stories, puzzle pages, fact pages and things. But in the Dalek book, they're all telling one big story. They all join up. And that story is the Dalek invasion of the solar system. But it doesn't tell you what happens on Earth, and it doesn't tell you how the Daleks are defeated. Because, I theorise, that's been written to dovetail with the Dalek invasion of Earth, which they are working on at the same time.
Ah.
That is a multimedia. That is the sort of stuff that I would get praised for doing now and for pitching. And they were doing it, and David was doing that in 1964. It's an extraordinary thing to do. And once you get onto that, you start going, oh, I think the stage play, The Curse of the Daleks, may be written to be a bridge between the two movies. And it doesn't quite work. You know, the continuity's not quite right, but he was always a bit vague on what year things were set in and whatever. And I think, a bit like Conan Doyle writing Sherlock Holmes, the continuity's a bit, because he didn't go back and reread anything. You know, he just went, oh, this fits in there, but I haven't actually checked the details.
Over a period of 40 years.
Yeah. So I think that's what's going on. And then with the Crusades and the Crusaders, the amazing thing about that is, it's a really sophisticated script, and I think what the TV version is David doing is kind of, it's the first thing he does after he's left the BBC, and he's trying to do something a bit more adult and outside the limits. He's trying to push the limits of what Doctor Who can do, and I think Dennis Spooner's quite keen to do that as the new story editor. So he commissions David to write this, you know, pushing the boundaries of what Doctor Who can do in terms of subject matter. At the same time, they've commissioned the Web Planet to push what they can do in terms of scale and sci-fi-ness. And so that's, you know, on TV, that's a thing. And then in the book, again, it's a quite faithful adaptation of what's on screen, but begins with a whole kind of thesis on changing history and the Doctor's role, which I think is in dialogue with what Dennis Spooner is doing in things like the Time Meddler. Where the whole thing at the time that is that you can change history and you can muck things up. So it's kind of like David's writing a response to that. You know, in my day, we wouldn't have done, you know, that's the kind of thing. And so what it means is you read that book on two registers, because the Doctor doesn't go, this is the rule. He says, this is what we're going to find out on the thing. What do you think? So you kind of read the book going, what does this expect? So it's amazing bit of writing. And both of them, you go, Who do you think you're writing for? Because these are both quite grown-up books. So as a kid, you feel kind of gratified because you're not being talked down to. So they kind of validate you as a viewer and stuff. So all of that is really, really important. And it means that when the books are republished in 1973, as a reader who's read old Doctor Who and remembers old Doctor Who, but you're now like 8 years older, that book would really resonate with you, because it makes you feel like what you watched is a very adult thing. So the success of Target, I think, is owes a great deal to those kind of, that how hard he worked on those books.
And lastly, how did you come to find the page from his Enemy of the World novelization?
So I was almost finished on the David Whittaker book. And I had made contact with his niece, Melanie. And I'd been down to visit her, and she had various bits of paperwork. And I knew that there was paperwork surviving, because some of it had been published in Doctor Who Magazine 200 in 1993. And what happened was that David Whittaker's second wife, Stephanie, died in 1990. And her mother then contacted David Whittaker's brother, who's in the UK, and said, I've got all of this stuff. Do you want it? And she posted it to him, these boxes of papers. And Melanie said, I think there were two or three boxes of it, and this is the one that survives. So I went through that. None of it related to Doctor Who.
Aww.
But, you know, lots of other stuff about his career and what he was involved in and whatever. And then I thought I'd finished a draft of the book last summer, and she rang me up and said, I found another box. And I was like, oh, great. How lovely. oh, well, I'm sure it doesn't have any... Is there anything Doctor Who related? Oh, yeah, the first thing is a contract. What? For what? Oh, for the novelisation of The Evil of the Daleks.
Oh!
What? So I went down to have a look. And yes, there was the contract for The Evil of the Daleks, signed about 6 weeks before he died, which is why he didn't deliver it. There was the synopsis for the Enemy of the World novelisation, how he would novelise it, which was published in Doctor Who Magazine 200. And a page. And actually half a page, because it's the title and then there's a blank space and whatever. You describe it as being quite childlike. I don't think that's what that is.
I'm saying that in a positive sense.
Oh yeah, but I don't think that's what that is. I think what he's writing is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which was, at the time he wrote it, had just been released and was a bestseller and was a novelization by the script editor of Doctor Who. And I think David was pitching to get back into Doctor Who and to impress Douglas Adams. That's my theory.
Wow. I was listening to an episode of the Bowery Boys podcast, which covers the history of New York City, where I
yeah.
live. They were talking about Greta Garbo and what she is doing in New York for the 50 years after she stops acting, but is still living in New York and walking around. She was still going to movies up until the very end. She dies, I think, in 1990. Greta Garbo bought a ticket and sat in the theater to watch Back to the Future.
Oh, amazing.
So that cross-pollination, David Whittaker writing to Douglas Adams in 1980 is a mind-blowing idea.
Well, there is some evidence. There was a party in 1978 to celebrate 15 years of Doctor Who. And there are two photos that survive. And Patrick Trout and John Pertwee and Tom Baker are all in the room together, and various other people. At Gallifrey last year, I was tipped off that I should talk to a fan in Australia who had met Stephanie Whittaker, David Whittaker's widow, in the 1980s, who had invited her to a convention. So I was like, yes, I got in touch. So at Gallifrey last year, I texted this guy and got a response back saying, yes, she came and talked to us. No, there was no recording made. There was no report other than she was there. But she had two things with her. One of them was a Japanese edition of the first Dalek story of the book, which she gave me, and wow. I've still got. And the other thing which she showed us was David's invitation to the 15th anniversary party, which was when she and David were living in London. Soon after that party, David Whittaker is working with Malcolm Hulk on a thing. Why did they join up? Why did they meet up? Where would have they got together? Well, the obvious place is that they were all at a party with Terence Dix and whatever. So my suspicion is that David Whittaker met Douglas Adams at the party, and Douglas Adams was the first fan of Doctor Who, who'd grown up with it, who got a job. And the first thing Douglas Adams did as script editor was say to Graham Williams, can we get Terry Nation to do a Dalek story? Because I'm a fan. So David Whittaker, who'd worked in comedy and light entertainment before getting in Doctor Who, which is what Douglas Adams had done. Douglas Adams is an extra in Monty Python's Flying Circus and had done a bit of acting and stage work. David Whittaker had done that. Douglas Adams leaves Doctor Who because it's been really hard, and also he's doing a novelization. That's what David Whittaker did. They would have had a lot in common, and they were both gregarious and funny and whatever. But we don't know. But I am haunted by the fact that they might have got on.
Oh.
And if David Whittaker's timing had been a little better, he might have written for season 17 or you know, any of those things. That kind of stuff haunts me.
And do we know if there is any more of that book still around? Do we know if he wrote more than the first page?
Nothing survives that I've seen.
Heartbreaking.
Maybe. It would be odd just to have written the first page.
Of course.
It's great, that page. It's beautiful, funny, witty, and really grabs your attention in a way that Time Lash does not. So we have checked. We have gone through the boxes and stuff, but sadly, tantalizing fragment.
Mark, do you have any questions for Simon?
Yeah, I'll just make a quick cameo to ask a question. Like a lot of Doctor Who fans, I was lucky enough to get Whotopia for Christmas, which is the beautiful new coffee table Doctor Who book by you, Jonathan Morris, and Una McCormack.
Yes, technically it's by Jonathan Morris, and Una and I were his assistants.
So. Oh, right. Oh. Well, yeah, the question was going to be, like, how did you each of you decide what to cover? Did you have things that you're like, I really want to write about? Or was it then, if Jonathan Morris was kind of in control of it, did he assign you things?
Yes. So Johnny came up with the idea and said, I want to do this, but I think it's too much. I'm going to pitch this, but I think it's too much for me to do on my own. Would you help out? And then he assigned us bits. But he also rewrote what we wrote and worked on, you know, and then Steve Cole, the editor, reworked on. So I think I wrote the first draft of the entry on Sarah Jane Smith. I think I wrote the first draft of the entry on the Masters. I think I wrote the first draft of some of the Doctors, I think. But then Johnny, you know, kind of sent me a redone version and
right. Whatever.
So it's all, what I mean is that yes, there were bits that I did, but actually it was a group effort. And I, flicking through it, can't remember what bits are mine and what bits are his. But it was really fun. The big thing was, it's subtitled, you know, The Guide to the Hooniverse. I didn't know what that was. They didn't tell us about the Hooniverse and things being on iPlayer. What they said was, we want this to be a guide, and yes, but for each entry about somebody, can you name the stories they're in? So, okay. That's not how we usually do this.
But now you can go on iPlayer and there it is.
But what that means is what we've written, without us realising, is a menu for iPlayer and lots of entryways in. So one of the things they asked me to do, I don't think I wrote the entry on the Daleks, but what they did ask me to do was, can you write a list of all the stories that Daleks appear in? And I was like all of them, like The Mind of Evil, yes. Oh, okay, so kind of went through, and it's a great big round blob on a picture. It's like, why are we doing that? That's an odd thing to do. And now I'm like, oh, I see what you're doing. Very clever. And that's really exciting. But also, this is such a game changing thing. In, you know, until last year, if I was writing a Doctor Who book for non-fiction, or if I was doing something for Doctor Who magazine or whatever, you can't assume that everybody knows Doctor Who brilliantly well. So if you refer to a story, you kind of have to summarise what it is, or what's at stake, or the bit that you're illustrating. Now, what you do is, you don't tell people what happens in the story, because you don't want to spoil it for them, but you kind of direct them in that space so they can go and watch it for themselves. So you can kind of go, oh, the Master first appears in Terror of the Autons. But actually what you say is, the Master first appears in season 8, : The Terror of the Autons, because that's how you find it on iPlayer. But for example, I've written a thing where we were kind of like, you know, significant moments in Doctor Who. And I said, well, significant moments is the end of Earthshot. But I don't want to spoil that for people who haven't seen it. So what you say is, this very exciting story at the end of which Adric leaves the TARDIS. Go and see season 19: Earthshock. And it's a completely different way of, and what that does is you kind of surrender authority, because you're not telling people the history of Doctor Who, you're letting them go off and do it for themselves, which is a really exciting, fun thing to do. So kind of engagement with the readership is very different as a result.
I want to ask you a final question. You and I are both wearing t-shirts designed by one of my producers, Jim Sangster.
Yes.
So the next question is courtesy of Jim Sangster. This is the final one. Your favorite cover painting on a Target novelization, and I assume Time Lash will not be your answer.
There is only one. I mean, there's loads I really, really love and are very personal to me, but there is only one. And that is Rory Knipe's painted cover of a Dalek exploding on the death of the Daleks, which I absolutely adore, and saw the artwork in the Cartoon Gallery exhibition in 2016. And it's tiny. The back of the Time Lash novelization has a poster for it.
Oh, yes.
I coveted that poster and never had one. That's what, when I'm king of Doctor Who, when I'm the showrunner, Doctor Who magazine, I'm going to tell them, do that as a poster, please, just because I want that.
Soon may that day arrive.
And they'll say, you can't do that as king of Doctor Who, you can't direct it, and I will go, yes I can, because otherwise I will blow up the planet. It's my fantasy has kind of got out of hand.
Simon Guerrier, thank you so much for joining us, and have a wonderful rest of the convention.
Thank you.
The vervoids are probably the best parody joke in Doctor Who.
They're hermaphroditic plants.
A lot of plants are.
So there you go. That's it's based on science.
No, they'll ship anything.
There are probably 11 and handle shippers out there. You just have to drill a hole where his mouth is, and you're all set.
You know, yeah. He needs the room. I've seen it in pictures.
I'm not saying you're not a fan. I'm saying you don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Doctor Who gives a fuck. A drunken Doctor Who podcast for the end times. You are listening to Doctor Who Literature. Keep turning the pages!
Doctor Who, Time Lash, by Glenn McCoy. Televised as Time Lash. Teleplay by Glenn McCoy and Eric Sayward. Screen credit to Glenn McCoy. Televised in March 1985. Paperback release date May 15th, 1986. Target book number 105. Cover artist David McAllister. The inhabitants of the planet Carvel are suffering under the tyrannical rule of their leader, the Borad, who has brought his world to the brink of interplanetary war. Those who dare to oppose the will of the Borad are mercilessly sacrificed to the Time Lash, a fate considered by many to be worse than death. When the Doctor arrives on Carvel, he soon discovers the Borad's horrifying plan, a plan which will directly affect his young American assistant, Perry. So Simon just crushed that interview, utterly crushed it. We covered a lot of points about the book and the TV. So I'll start off then, rather than cover the same ground, by talking about what used to be my second favorite sport, boxing. You can tell a lot about a Doctor Who novelization by its opening paragraph. Muhammad Ali used to intentionally go into a clinch in the first round of a title fight in order to gauge his opponent's strength. If he came out of the clinch laughing, you knew it was going to be a short fight. When the greatest, in the mid-late 1970s, was getting older and bulkier and slower, and when his opponents were carefully selected to protect him, though honestly it was probably too late, a lot of the damage had already been done, he fought a completely unknown Belgian boxer named Jean-Pierre Koopman. Koopman, for this fight, went by the nickname the Lion of Flanders, a name invented by publicists for the fight, as Koopman himself was a colorless tomato not worthy of a nickname. Koopman worshipped Ali and was terrified to so much as lay a glove on him. Spoiler alert, he wouldn't. The legend has it that Ali grabbed Koopman in the clinch in the first round and came out laughing, though the fight's on YouTube and I can't quite pinpoint that moment myself. Supposedly, Ali called out to the TV executives sitting in the front row that the fight was never going to last long enough to make the commercial breaks profitable. This was February 20th, 1976 in San Juan, Puerto Rico, with American ratings of about 40 million viewers. Good luck a boxing match getting that many viewers today. There's every chance my father was watching live on TV, and I was probably bouncing around the room somewhere behind him. Ali knocked out Koopman in five. Koopman finished with a career record of 36-16-2, which is, by the way, atrocious. I mean, better than I would do in the ring, but still. So let's take our wisdom earned from Ali Koopman and bring it to Doctor Who. Let's do what Ali did and grab that opening sentence in a clinch. Both Fraser Gregory and Andrew Smith have quizzed me on this show on the great opening lines from Target Books. You'll notice Timelash was not in either quiz. This is how Timelash, that most unloved of TV serials, begins in book form. Quote, "A purple haze glistened upon the conglomeration of pyramids that made up the planet Carful's principal city." Yeah. Literally purple prose, purple the second word of the book, and a run-on sentence, doesn't really set the tone for what's happening over the next 117 pages after this one. But let's be fair. Even Jean-Pierre Koopman, the Lion of Flanders, did knock out 20 of his 36 wins. Timelash is our book of the month, so let's acknowledge when it does stick its jabs and land its crosses and bobs and weaves out of danger. Glenn McCoy keeps us guessing which two of the previous three Target books, Time Monster and Galaxy 4, episodes 102 and 104 of this podcast, did not do. Like Twin Dilemma, episode 103, Timelash does something different with its wildly unpopular season 22 forebear by telling a different story with the book than was told on TV. Characters in this novelization do have backstories and motivation, and there's more of a sense that Carful has a tragic history and logical reasons for them to have developed the nonsensical civilization that we saw on TV. But McCoy cannot make chicken soup out of the chicken feathers of his TV script. Still a bad story. The DVD text commentary tells us that McCoy went through a number of draft scripts, discarding ideas left and right. Terrence, back in the 70s, had a three-draft rule, and after that, he'd just go out and write the thing himself. McCoy's novelization mostly adapts the final Eric Sayward-influenced draft, rather than the earlier rejected ideas. Now, the prose? Not great, but it's not Philip Martin-level bad. And be thankful that the novelization of Vengeance on Varus was delivered 2 years late, so it's a while before we have to tackle that one on Doctor Who literature. But McCoy writes in stodgy sentences that do not flow together very well, which is especially galling as this book comes right after Robert Holmes if you're reading in story order, and so soon after a Terrence novelization in publication order. Important plot points are data dumped in expository prose rather than being organically revealed through dialogue and action. A lot of the data dumping comes via extraneous clauses thrown in at the back of run-on sentences. As with the glut of characters, these are signs that McCoy doesn't really know how to tell his story. We could talk, and Simon and I did, about how Carful has too many counselors and too many rebels. Pop quiz, hot shot. Which one is Kendrin and which one is Brunner? At times, the author seems unfamiliar with how to convey actions and emotions in the English language. Quote, "She could feel her pulse race to keep her frightened body functioning as her spirit regained composure despite her unpredictable future." Say what now? So let's go in order through the changes. Chapter 1, way too busy. 14 pages out of the shortest Target book in quite some time, introducing too many minor characters, each with a long backstory. Aram, Gazak, Tahir, Sezin, Katz, as well as the Doctor and Perry, who appear via a long Sayward-penned TV TARDIS fight scene. Hard to make out what this book is about when we're thrown into all of this at once. Sezin and Katz didn't debut on TV until much later in the story, and the Aram, Gazak, and Tahir trio would have been better served by consolidation into a single character, or maybe two, at best. Does the chapter end with Sezin actually seeing the Borat, or only imagining him? Clunky writing. Chapter 2 reveals Gazak's entire life story, and that's interesting, but it's revealed on literally his final page, and that's it for him in the book. Chapter 2 also introduces all the Inner Sanctum counselors at once, most of them instantly forgettable. Although at least Tecker mirrors Paul Darrow's vain attempts to inject life into the TV story. Quote, ambitious, vibrant, and highly charged with self-opinionated charm. One nice turn of phrase has the newly promoted Tecker wearing the amulet of office about his neck and power firmly in his grasp, end quote. Later on, McCoy quotes Shakespeare, giving Tecker a, quote, lean, hungry look. That's great, Chief, but Tecker, as played by Paul Darrow, was not quite lean and hungry, more like large and smarmy. No, and by the way, McCoy was not the only Target author in the spring of 1986 to use that line. Come back next week to hear it again. But for all the endless backstories given to minor characters, action sequences are beyond McCoy's abilities, with, for example, Vena falling into the time lash in flat, cursory prose without any hint of tension or terror. It's hard to tell if the author has reprehensible attitudes or is merely commenting on them. A metaphor about a character about to be clubbed to death, quote, like a seal about to be culled, is tasteless. Even worse, quote, Sezen was rattled. He was not used to being challenged, especially by a woman. The doctor, in chapter 2, thinks for way too long about Perry's, quote, eternal nagging, something that he could little tolerate and worked to avoid at all costs. This book, came out in 1986, was casual misogyny still acceptable at that late date? And I thought Galaxy 4 last week had some misogynist sentences. Although that, at least, had the benefit of being the adaptation of a 20-year-old script written by an old fossil who predated the good ship Women's Lib. The print doctor bears the TV persona's arrogant essence, quote, he had to admit that Perry had a valid point, though he was not going to tell her that. McCoy goes far afield from TV in spots. Many Sayward penned padding sequences are not retained, with one notable exception, which we'll come to later. Added are long sequences about 24 Borad clones and about a death squad of 50 killer androids sent to the Inner Sanctum. The former sequence, however, is just two characters wandering into a room, and then that plot thread is quickly forgotten. The death squad scene I actually like. It adds a tension to the climax utterly missing on TV, where the under-running script was filled instead with an interminable 6-minute Sayward padding sequence added into the middle of a life-or-death countdown. Of course, the death squad sequence, which would have been impossible to stage on TV, is resolved in book form when McCoy has a character accidentally jostle the doctor's elbow. Wait, what? Even worse, McCoy then leaves in that 6-minute padding sequence in the book anyway, pages 113 to 115. Although when you put it that way, 3 pages doesn't seem nearly as interminable as the TV equivalent. William Ems in the longer Galaxy 4 book would have gotten 10 pages out of the same material. What else do I want to talk about? We've talked about boxing already. Okay, when you say, what do I want to talk about? Nothing. What I will talk about, since this is Time Lash's only week in the spotlight here on Doctor Who Lit. If you open any page of the book out of context and read the dialogue, you will see an utter lack of naturalism or realism. But on page 108, McCoy gives us the earliest novelization adaptation, I think, Colin Baker's Doctor's Trick, of saying the same word 3 times and getting louder each time. Trick, queried the Time Lord, moving back from the power panels. Trick, he snapped, rubbing the sweat from his forehead. Trick, he shouted, humbling poor Micros, who recoiled. That's the best word choice there, by the way. Humbled? Humbled! Humbled! Page 110, Perry's American accent, quote, strongly contrasts with Herbert's precise English articulation. I think that's bad writing, but I'm sure most of my UK listeners who've had me in their ear for the last 2.5 years can relate to Herbert. The last paragraph of chapter 11 is a wild and crazy ride full of improbable and illogical prose, as somebody once said. Quote, everyone turned round. It was the doctor. He bounced into the chamber, full of life, to the enormous joy of everyone except Perry, who was a little tied up with another matter. Micros, delighted to see the Time Lord, stepped aside to let the doctor through. End of chapter. The tell-don't-show is endless. Page 119. The anti-climax. Seriously, this story has about 5 different conclusions. It is reported by McCoy. Like a less grammatically correct Walter Cronkite on the CBS Evening News in 1967, quote, Vina announced the departure of the Banjul ship from its mother craft, which was orbiting the planet. This was a cue for the Borad to demand action to his request. His plan was to charge the leading pad. Yes, it says the leading pad, not the landing pad. Back to the book. With explosives, and set a trembler for auto detonation as soon as the craft made contact with a landing jetty. Yep, we get both leading pad and landing jetty in the same sentence. Landing pad appears on the next page, by the way. Perry's reaction to seeing Herbert's full name is, quote, she could not believe her eyes. You're the writer? Can't you just make us believe? And the TV is actually better than the book in spots, which is the opposite of how these things normally go. Colin Baker gets a funny bit when someone asks him if a burning android that mysteriously appeared 1 hour before the Doctor zapped it with a time crystal was his handiwork. In the book, the Doctor responds by saying it's nice to know that his plan will have already worked, or something else of dubious temporal sense. On TV, Colin Baker only stares at the camera and says, "What?" A much better acting choice. But at the same time, the horrific line, delivered by Colin Baker on TV, quote, a fat female Morlocks with a slinky walk, is not in the book. That TV line screams of Eric Sayward's particular brand of violent misogyny. But, of course, mock this book as I do, I was once 12 years old and understood it, liked it, read it more than once. There are additions in the book that work very well. Perry has been chained by the Borad in front of a Morlocks and is freed by the Doctor and Herbert. In the book, however, the Doctor frees her a little more dramatically. Page 98. The Doctor lifted the M80 cylinder and unscrewed the top very slowly. Getting Herbert to drop the wooden stake, he sprayed the length of it with the dangerous element, leaving one end free from the unstable chemical. Containing the cylinder once more, he laid it to one side, lifting the stake like a javelin, and with one almighty lunge projected the wooden stick straight into the open mouth of the snapping Morlocks. What happened next was quite remarkable. The Morlocks amalgamated with the wood, the latter growing and expanding in every direction. Large stakes protruded from every part of the animal's body like a vast network of new bones. The effect meant instant death for the Morlocks, and a reminder to the Doctor of Mustakazine's power and instability. Now, at about the time this book came out, so did the David Cronenberg version of The Fly, which my father took me to see in the theater that summer. Remembering back to episode 103, when I talked about the intersection of sci-fi fandom and sports fandom, my dad grew up enjoying the original David Hedison / Vincent Price Fly movie of 1958, as much as he enjoyed the Yankees defeating the Milwaukee Braves in the World Series 3 months later. In the 1986 Fly, at the end, Jeff Goldblum winds up horrifically merged with the metal of the transmat capsule before John Getz's character kills him. By the way, Callie and I watched The Last of Us last month, and I tried to explain to her who John Getz was, but the information was meaningless to her. Now, by chance, coming back from the theater, I had my copy of Time Lash in the car, and I reread the scene. As traumatizing as the movie was for me, seriously, I would not arm wrestle again for decades after that. I was traumatized even more. Could the writers of The Fly have read the Time Lash novelization too? I wondered. Did they get their ideas from the same place? Now, the Time Lash book is not good, and to quote Jeremy Bentham, it is bad and ugly, but it is of a piece with the other target books of the era. It attempts to not just adapt the TV story line by line, stage direction by direction, but it also tries to experiment, expand, augment. There are deleted subplots in the book not on TV, as well as new and better, or, if not better, at least different, ideas that occurred to McCoy after the sorry, soggy thing went before the cameras. The French expression for that is l'esprit d'escalier. The Yiddish expression is trepverter, or stair words that come to you on the stairs as you're walking away. The novelization gives the author a chance to look back on his own story and make fixes to the scope of the thing. Several other target books that we'll be covering here in the months to come, books that come after mid-1986, will follow this same Time Lash model. So, and here's a new sentence that I'm just about to say for the first and probably last time. Thank you, Time Lash.
Where's Perry? You promised a safe return.
Ah, yes. Well, you shouldn't believe everything that people tell you, Doctor.
You gave me your word, you microcephalic apostate. I demand to see the Borad immediately.
Admit defeat, Doctor.
Never.
The stories I've heard about you, the great Doctor, all-knowing and all-powerful. You're about as powerful as a burnt-out android. Our ruler has finished with you, once and for all.
We can't do this, Tegra.
Shut up, or you'll be joining him.
You're as warped as your dictator, friend.
Save your breath for the time lash, Doctor. Most people depart with a scream.
The vortex is ready, Merlin.
Dispatch the Doctor first. Goodbye, Doctor. Unpleasant journey.
Next time on Doctor Who Literature. And by the way, Paul Darrow is just really, really good in that scene, especially on audio. Doesn't it work really well without the visuals or without the direction? Next week, having already covered some of the low points of the classic series by popular perception, the Gunfighters, the Time Monster, Twin Dilemma, Galaxy 4, Time Lash, we're going to sidestep in time. And we're going to discuss the very first original full-length Doctor Who novel, which came out as a Target book in the spring of 1986. The Doctor is not featured. It is the first of three books in the short-lived Companions of Doctor Who series, and we have a returning Doctor Who novelist, my good friend Dale Smith, back on the show to discuss the Companions of Doctor Who, Turlo, and the Earthlink Dilemma. Be afraid. Be very afraid. That's next week on Doctor Who Literature. Thank you for joining me. This podcast is produced by David Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. This week's episode was written and edited by me. Our logo, designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my very special guest, Simon Gurrier, recorded live at Gallifrey One in Los Angeles a week ago. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Blue Sky and YouTube at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.